Indigenous communities have historically been wary of the American education system. Historically, they have good reason. In the 1800s, some 350 Indian boarding schools were established where students were taken away from their families and forbidden to speak their native language. And only now, the U.S. government is reckoning with the hundreds of unmarked graves found at some of these schools. And according to the Post-Secondary National Policy Institute, only 24% of Native American and Alaska Native students attend a college or university. That compares to 41% of the U.S. population. At UNLV, which for years has been ranked as the most or one of the most diverse campuses in the country, they're trying to change that. This isn't the first time UNLV has tried to draw Indigenous students to campus, but it's the university's first Native youth summer camp. Devin Harris is the associate director for UNLV's early outreach program, and Sarah Mae Agbalai is an undergraduate social work student. Her work is the basis for much of the Native youth summer camp. Devin and May, I'll call you. Welcome to State of Nevada. I'm sorry for butchering your last name.
It's okay. It happens a lot.
<I'm sorry.
laughs> Tried your best.
Devin, I'll start with you. This isn't the first event UNLV has done with Native youth, but it is possibly one of the largest. What makes this camp different?
Yeah, I think what makes this camp different is how much thought and intention went into the planning of making sure that whatever programming we were going to have these students involved in specifically related to what needs our Native youth encounter the most. What is it that they need most in coming to a college campus? And what is it that they need to see, feel? Who is it that they need to hear from in order to really feel like college is a place that they could be and that they could fit in? So,
and that is, if you read about this, and a little bit later we're going to be talking to Assistant Professor Merton Runningwolf at UNR. There are quite a few different needs that some of these students require. What are some of the things that you found?
Yeah, one of the biggest needs is definitely that college and career awareness and readiness. So a lot of our Native students, especially those that live on the reservation, just don't have as much access to this information. And so one of, our biggest goals with this camp was making sure that the students and the chaperones, because they'll go back and share that with the families, really understand what they should be doing now at this point in their middle or high school journey in order to make that college application process a lot smoother. Financial aid is a huge piece of that as well, and understanding what scholarships and fee waivers exist specifically for Native students.
And a lot of the research and the things I've read about this also have a lot to do with the cultural differences. The 27, and there might be more, 27 different tribal groups throughout Nevada. Some of them are very isolated, hundreds of miles from other people. It could be a very, very different lifestyle. And when they get to some of these bigger universities like UNLV in a major city like Las Vegas, that could be a shock. How do you deal with something like that?
Absolutely. So we did find that in our research that there were a lot of misconceptions about what post-secondary life looks like for our students, especially in a city like Las Vegas. So in coming to campus, being able to give them that experience of living in the dorms, and giving them the opportunity to meet Native UNLV current college students and to hear what their college experience looks like and get all those questions answered, about the clubs and the organizations and the resources that exist to make sure that they can make as smooth a transition as possible, not only while they're at UNLV, but after they graduate and perhaps go out into the community or return, back to their reservation or wherever home is for them.
Yeah, I read off some figures earlier about the low rate of university enrollment by Indigenous youth. What's the intention of a program like this? I mean, after this program, for instance, you just finished this camp. I mean, what were some of the reactions? And what are you looking for a percent increase? I mean, what are you looking for?
Yeah, actually, I was just sharing the data with May. We had our students take a pre-survey and then a post-survey. And we were really looking at, in coming in, how much did they know about the college application process? And another thing that we were really interested in is how much did they understand about how college could impact their community? Because that was a huge piece that we found in our research, that, you know, Native communities are really close-knit. And so it's a lot of times very scary and, you know, for their young people to leave and go off to college and not know, will they come back? You know, and it was amazing to see the percentage of students that were unsure about how college could impact their community. And looking at the data now, that's one of the pieces I'm most proud of, is that they've made that connection through the programming.
What do you mean? What's the data show?
Yeah. So, I mean, during the different events that we have planned, like thinking about the neuroscience that they went to, UNLV TV and KUNV radio, looking at all those different ways, hospitality, there's just so many opportunities that they had being on campus to see, wow, I can major in this, I can study this while I'm at college, you know, and I can network and make these different relationships and then graduate and bring that knowledge and those skills back to serve my community. I have a great example, a student, Tristan, who's actually coming to UNLV, and he's going to be majoring in physical therapy. And he told us in McDermott, you know, you have to go 4 hours one way or the other to get any kind of services like that. So he's so excited that he's going to be able to study that at UNLV, go back and bring that knowledge and that skill set.
You know, I get that excitement. It'd be great for a young person, 17, 18 years old, to go to a campus, hear somebody like you speak. You're very enthusiastic. And coming out of it, they might say, oh, gosh, this is for me. But how do you maintain that? Once they get back to where they live, that can fade away pretty quickly.
Absolutely. So the great thing is early outreach operates year-round. So one of our biggest things, and I shared this, it was awesome when I was checking the group out, got to talk with two of the chaperones that live in McDermott, and they said, tell us more about early outreach, what you all do. So I shared our menu of services with them, that, you know, we're out in the schools all the time out here in Clark County, but everything that we do in person can be done virtually as well. But also, we have an admissions counselor who plans a northern trip. And I told them that how awesome would it be if early outreach could join her and we could bring some of those, you know, presentations and activities and, you know, that college and career awareness and readiness to your students and families, you know, in McDermott or up north. So I'm already in talks about making a trip.
UNLV has focused on this a little bit in the past, but this really sounds like the first time it's really getting some intensive focus. Do you know why that is?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest reasons, obviously, is what data shows. But beyond data, I think it relates back to our mission at UNLV. And, you know, we are such a diverse university, and we want to make sure, though, that we're representative of all different ethnicities and, you know, all different backgrounds. And, you know, Native, our data for Native students is very, very, very minimal. And so we know as a university that that's somewhere we need to be focused, but we need to do it early on so that these students know in middle and high school, I even say elementary, you know, that college is an option for them. And this is how they can make it happen. And this is what they need to do at this point in their journey.
Joining the conversation now is Sarah Mae Agbale. Her research has informed much of the activity in the program. Mae, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Great to have you here. So, Mae, this is a student population that is often under-recognized, very misunderstood. I wonder what you did to try to get beyond the veneer, to understand their needs better.
Right. So in social work, we learn so much about how being culturally competent is so important for working with clients. And I just found that within my classes, as much as we try to learn about certain populations, there's only so much that you can learn through textbooks or through research. So being able to go out into the community and interview with individuals who have experience working with certain populations really has a much greater impact. So I felt that was one of the main things that I wanted to do, was to be able to actually talk to people, which was a little bit difficult with COVID and everything, but even being able to do so over Zoom and being able to really understand the needs of the population from members of the community.
And when they talked to you, what did they say was important in a program like this? What did they want to see universities doing more of to make these students feel comfortable?
Right. So one of the main things that I got from Lance West, who I spoke with from Northern Nevada, he told me how much Native students aren't able to see Native Americans represented within the classroom, whether that's through their teachers or through the education that they receive, and how there tends to be some overgeneralization with Native American culture. And then being able to really understand each individual sovereign nation by themselves really makes a big impact. So he was really adamant that being able to understand each of the students and understand their background, and also not overgeneralizing the information that we do receive, because there is going to be some aspects of their culture that apply to them, but also some that don't. So he really wanted us to keep that in mind when we did our programming, and also understanding the differences between the challenges for students on reservation as well as off the reservation as well.
You know, we're all impacted by the media, TV and movies especially. So we come up with stereotypes over generalizations. What are some of those? What are some of those that professors might have, that other students might have in the university now that you think have to change?
I think that one of the biggest things that at least I experienced, just like for media, is that these people don't exist anymore. And they do. It's just that they're often not as represented within media. So we tend to think that all these things happened in the past, and then not understanding the current things in place that are really oppressing this population. So I think that that was one of the biggest stereotypes that at least I held coming into the conversations, because living on this land, I had no idea whose land it was. I had no idea who had stewarded this land for generations. And I found a big problem with that, because I live here and I have no idea any of the history or the background. So I think that that was one of the main things that I found, is that many people are just not aware. They don't have the information and they don't seek that information out.
What about generalizations about the students themselves? About maybe how they are in a classroom? Did anything like that come out?
Yeah, so I actually found within my research that communication patterns for Native American youth tend to be much more nonverbal than we are used to in Western culture. And that can kind of translate as students not being participatory in the classroom, or it can also translate for the teachers not really paying attention to these students because they tend to communicate more nonverbally. So that was one of the main things that I found that really impacts Native youth in the classroom, is that their quietness can be used to really hold negative opinions towards them.
And is that the kind of information then that Devin Harris, that you give to her, and that gets passed on to professors who potentially will be teaching these students?
I mean, we would hope so. We definitely used it within the Native Youth Camp to provide them with those opportunities to get out of their comfort zone and use more verbal communication, and also communicate with people that will understand the way that they communicate with each other. And we would hope that in the future that professors and teachers from K-12 would be much more aware of these different communication patterns throughout different cultures and be able to integrate those within the classroom and not punish students for the way that their culture has taught them to behave.
Now we're joined by Assistant Professor Merton Runningwolf. He studies race and media at the University of Nevada, Reno. Professor, welcome back to State of Nevada.
Thank you so much. It's good to be back with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you, Professor. Yeah. You grew up on the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana. In your own words, from stories I've read, home life was surrounded by alcohol, drugs, violence, poverty. Coming from that, first of all, I wonder what it was like for you to move from that to a large university campus.
Yeah. Actually, my mom, we back and forth between the Blackfeet Reservation in Browning, Montana, and actually in Northern Nevada. My mom didn't want us to go to school in Browning because at the time it was such a violent place. And I do not believe that they offered a high school diploma from the high school. They offered a certificate of completion, and then they would help you get a GED if you wanted to do that after graduation. So my mom actually raised us down here because she felt that the mountains of the Sierra Nevadas and Lake Tahoe reminded her of Glacier National Park. And so she raised us here. But during the summers, we would go back and live with my grandmother on the Blackfeet Reservation. Really, really violent. Coming from that, I think that the idea of what extreme poverty is like, what that kind of violence is like, and how that informs a sense of place in the world, and whether or not we feel welcome or even understood when we get into a classroom. So this idea of like nonverbal communication or the way that we communicate in a class, for me, was often misinterpreted as being either aggressive or noncompliant, disinterested, lazy. So there were a lot of problems that I had when I would go to school, whether that was Stanford or NYU or USC, all these places. But I think because I studied and a lot of my study was about media representations, a lot of my professors, a lot of my educators, non-native ones, almost exclusively non-native ones, had very stereotypical ideas of what Native Americans should, how they should behave, how they should act, that just did not align with what I knew as reality.
So what do you think about this program at UNLV? What do you think it needs? And you've seen sort of the syllabus of the program. What do you think right. It needs to help Indigenous youth feel comfortable with leaving the confines of an isolated community, and probably for these young people, community that they don't think communities outside will understand?
Right. So looking just really quickly at just doing some preliminary research for this interview, I looked at what the fall enrollment for 2021 was for UNLV for American Indian students. And I'm not sure if that's self-identified. The statistic breakdown didn't say if it was self-identified or if these are enrolled tribal members or not. It did list out of the population that there were a total of 76 Native American students. I'm not sure if that was self-identified or not. Mm-hmm. Of that population, and if it was in line with Nevada population and national population, it should be closer to about 400, between 400 and 450. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of work to be done in terms of like just building the student enrollment there. But I think that if you're coming from a rural American Indian reservation and you only bump into a scarcity of 75, so that's about 20%. 20% of where it should be. So it's hard enough if you're making this transition coming from a place like Browning or coming from a place like Pyramid Lake or Hungry Valley or Dresslerville. If you're coming to a place like that and there are no Native Americans, then you feel alienated. You don't feel a sense of community. And a sense of community is what we found here at the Reynolds School of Journalism was one of the most important issues, was that not just that you see recognizable faces, but there's a relationship there that you can lean on as well, people that understand. But when you have a student enrollment of 75, and we have a similar enrollment crisis here at the University of Nevada, Reno, mm-hmm. it makes it really, really difficult to talk about a sense of community or a sense of belonging or even feeling welcomed here. What are the historical reasons? What is going on? And why are those numbers, those enrollment numbers so low? Because if we broke that down, the 76, or just to make the math easy, 75, we broke that down between freshmen, sophomores, juniors, seniors, and graduate students, that's an average of 15 per class, 15 Native American students per class. That's really low, really, really low. And so when you're talking about, if we have 27, if we use that number, 27 sure. tribal communities in the state of Nevada, that's less than one student coming from each one of those communities here. So that becomes really, really difficult and real challenge to overcome in terms of like, how do you create an environment when you're not really focused on building that number?
Okay, that is a massive issue. You're talking about a huge discrepancy there. What do you give me two ideas you think universities, UNR and UNLV, could incorporate to help these students? You know, I think, as you said, a lot of it has to do with comfort. How do you make them feel more comfortable? You can't force kids to go to school.
Right. I think that some of our strategies in the past have been well-intentioned, but they're ineffective because we have been dealing with this problem or having strategies to deal with this problem. But a lot of that is this kind of more come to our campus, come to our home territory and see how we do things. And so this old idea of the American Indian boarding school legacy of saying, come here, we're going to show you a better life away from your home and see how awesome it is if you come away from your home. That sounds great, but actually that creates a real division between our kids coming from tribal communities and coming here and being wowed by things. And I think that oftentimes these tours are set up to be these kind of like wow factors. Look at all this great stuff, but it creates an alienation. And we're more focused on the students, but what we're really kind of looking at is a dynamic that has to do with parents, grandparents, tribal councils, tribal leadership, the elder community. how does this speak to all of these different things? Because if we're only focused on getting high school juniors and seniors to come to these campuses, we're really ignoring the rest of that community. And that becomes really, really important if we're going to actually do that. And so for me, the idea is you need to go out to those communities, which I think oftentimes there's no funding for that. And you need to have a sustained presence. So one of the things that we're working on here at the University of Nevada, Reno is something called an ambassador program, where once a month we go out with a student group, a Native American student group, that goes out to each of one of our tribal locations. And we talk to those students about what their needs are. Rather than telling them, look at all the awesome stuff that we have for you, we say, what is it that you need? What is it that your community, your parents, your grandparents, your tribal leaders, what do you need? And how might we help you accomplish that? And then we listen to what they have. And so when we do our campus visits, which are in the third or fourth visit down the road, we know how to address those concerns and what to show them based on what their interest is. Rather than trying to parade things out and overwhelm them, we say, no, this is what they ask, this is what they look for. And then we do follow-ups. We go back out to those reservations and we check in with them, again, student-led, and we say, what questions do you have now that we showed you the things that you were interested in? But of course, the campus tour does show off, you know, some of the things that they may not have considered and some of the great benefits of our program, but it's very much based on what they want rather than us kind of parading out in front of them.
You're a professor at UNR educating students on race and media, and your work in the past has focused a lot on how media shapes the way certain groups of people see themselves. Does that also hold for educators who are trying to reach students, that they too are misled by the media, that they might internalize things or stereotypes they've seen in TV or movies, even when they are very, very wrong?
Oh, definitely. I think that Philip DeLoria, one of our scholars, one of our Native American scholars, the son of Vine DeLoria Jr., he talks about the idea of how history is formed and who gets to tell the stories. And he uses a great example of talking about World War II. So you have the military narrative, right? So the U.S. military goes in there and we win the war. And then you also have the German narrative or the Nazi narrative, but one that we often, so we have this kind of binary, but the one that we know that exists and we regularly acknowledge is, what about Holocaust survivors? So we have this very complex idea of thinking about what history are we listening to? Which history are we paying attention to? And I think that frequently, the dominant narrative that our educators listen to is a very Hollywood-centric idea of Native American history, rather than listening to what the students have to say about who they are, where they come from, what their communities are like. They impose, and again, this idea of trust comes up, this imposition of looking at self or looking at community in a certain way through an authority figure that does not know your community, but it says, no, I know about you because I have been saturated for generations by Hollywood's depiction of the kind of like mystical warrior mystique or the long-suffering savage mystique. And these things just do not align with the reality of these students' lives. And so they feel oftentimes because they tend not to be forthcoming, they feel overwhelmed by this. And again, we reflect back on the idea of forced assimilation or an idea of, we know who you are, we know what is good for you, and we push that narrative on you.
You know, in about the last couple of years, there's been huge focus on indigenous populations in this country. A lot of it has to do, you know, with something a lot of people didn't know about, the unmarked graves at the 350 Indian boarding schools, including one near Carson City. So this has taken on more importance, and I'm wondering about the point of looking at this from the point of view of universities. Like, how important is it now for a university to get more enrollment from Indigenous students? How does it burnish their reputation to do this, or is this really something? I mean, we have two people here from UNLV. Is this really something that is going to get lip service, or is it actually going to get more focus, do you think, in the coming years?
Well, I think that one of the things, and it's interesting to talk about these unmarked graves, because there was a big outcry when First Nations in Canada found these bones underneath, these skeletal remains underneath buildings, and thousands of them. But one of the things that I think happens when we talk about what happened in North America and the United States is that they're like, well, we're not finding these hidden bones. Well, no, they're kind of like out in the open. They're actually placed in cemeteries and unmarked graves. And there's almost a dismissal that these children actually suffered this kind of maltreatment, this kind of like abuse. And many of them died there. But because they're not buried under buildings and hidden, that they're out in plain view, that doesn't count as much. And that's simply not true. But I do think that one of the things that happened that is interesting, and I heard many scholars talk about this, is in the early 90s, maybe 1990, NAGPRA, Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, was passed. But here we are 32 years later, and many of these skeletal remains and cultural items have not been repatriated, have not been returned to the tribes. And other scholars have noticed this, and I've said it. We have more dead Native Americans on many of our college campuses than we have living students that are actually enrolled at those universities. So this becomes something that becomes lip service. It's like, oh yes, we want Native Americans here, but we actually value the object. We value the objectification of Native American skeletal remains more than we actually value living Native American students being part of our population. And so this becomes one of those things that, yes, lip service says, oh yes, we value you, but we actually value the skeletal remains more than you, because we know that this law was passed 32 years ago, but we're still wrestling with it. We're still fighting over it, because Native American artifacts, whether they're skeletal remains or whether they're cultural items, are more valuable to the institution, either monetarily or in terms of their reputation, than the actual living students themselves.
But do you think universities now are going to heed this more?
I think that one of the problems with NAGPRA is that enforcing that law becomes really, really difficult. And a lot of universities have figured out that all they have to do, because there's not a lot of investment in trying to actually clear the air of these violations, that a lot of the university has realized all we have to do in order to hold on to these artifacts that give us a great reputation, all we have to do is launch some kind of legal contest against that. And there is no resource. There is no structure in place among the tribes that actually can do this. There are so many social challenges among our tribal communities that they don't have the resources, the time, nor the finances to actually go ahead and follow through with this. So you see a lot of colleges and universities that are just like, yeah, we really want to get those back to you, but you know, it's just a court thing right now, or it's an administrative thing, but we're working on it. And this becomes one of those things. It's just like, okay, if it's been 32 years, how long are we going to wait? And this sends a clear message of how we value and how we listen to the Native American voice